This is the famous ringmaster, Chris Connors, and I'm here on behalf of my good friends, and you are going to listen to them right here, right now, Transatlantic History Ramblings with Lauren and Ryan.
Good evening and welcome to Transatlantic History Ramblings with Lauren and Brian. This is Brian in Buffalo, New York, US of A, and with me as always
is Lauren from Swansea, and I think I was meant to be the one that introduces this evening's episode. But
you were, okay. But I jumped the gun. I'm so excited for today. I jumped the gun.
No, you didn't. You just don't like me speaking.
Oh, are you trying to start the hate mail again, Lauren?
I don't need to start anything for you to get hate mail.
That's true. That's true. I'm sorry. I'm not really sorry, but you know what yesterday was, Lauren?
It was Eclipse Day.
It was Eclipse Day, and we were right in the path here in Buffalo. It was like over 1 million people came to Buffalo, another million people came to Niagara Falls, and over 500,000 came to Rochester. And guess what happened? No guess?
Nothing.
There was an eclipse. No, it was really it was really cloudy for most of it, but then we did see the eclipse, and it was pretty fucking cool. I'm not gonna lie.
I have to say though, I was disappointed because I was led to believe by America that yesterday was meant to be the rapture.
No rapture. I mean, I played Blondie's Rapture. Does that count?
No.
I didn't even. Now Sarah's calling me out on my bullshit. I didn't even play Rapture by Blondie. Yeah. Anyway, Lauren, do you have an eclipse in Wales yesterday?
Nope.
Well, guess who's not special then, huh?
We've had them before. Yeah, and I'm quite lucky where I live because it's a village. It's not quite rural. It's a commuter village, but we do get quite a bit of stars, so I am quite lucky in that respect.
You do, And I'm excited because tonight's show is one I've been looking so forward to for such a long time because we're diving back into the history of performance and, in particular, clowning with, in my opinion, the greatest living clown. My second favorite clown of all time, the amazing, the fantastic, the wonderful Dot Cotton, will be joining us to discuss clowning and clowning history and her career and her life and her influences and just everything. And they're going to love it, Lauren. And we'll let them in on a little secret. Yeah, you know, they're recorded separately. So, you know, how did you think the interview was?
I thought it was lovely. She's a very lovely person. And it just made me think about... I don't know why, but Dan Leno in particular, and it made me think about when I went to the Museum of London for the first time, and there was they're not there now, but I think they're coming back. But there were facades of Victorian shops, and one of them was a stationer's, and it had a picture of a Christmas card of Dan Leno peering out, and it had his catchphrase, "Here we are again." It always freaked me out.
You know what freaks me out, speaking of Christmas cards?
What?
It reminds me of the last time I actually bought a Christmas tree. Do you buy Christmas trees, or do you have an artificial one?
We buy Christmas trees.
Yeah. Last time I went to buy a Christmas tree, I went to the lot, and the dude working there said, "Are you going to put it up yourself?" And I said, "No, you damn pervert. I'm going to put it in the living room."
That was a bit much.
That was funny.
That was a bit much.
Why?
So, have we had any emails?
Yeah, lots of them.
Okay.
Well, you know, we just got off a three-part series of weird and strange and wild and wacky paranormal stuff.
Yeah.
And people love that shit, Lauren. They, like, go gaga over it. And, you know, a lot of compliments, a lot of people writing in about how freaky these things are, about how scary they are, about how much, you know, they love Tim and Kurt. But we also got more mail about my jokes.
Okay. Yeah, whatever.
Are they pro or con, you're thinking, right?
I think you make up a lot of these emails about your jokes, to be fair.
People love the jokes, Lauren.
They're some, awful. Well,
that's not true, because we did get a couple this week that they didn't like the jokes. One person wrote in and said, the jokes are so terrible. Sometimes I laugh because they're so bad, but the ones last week were just bad.
Yeah.
Which means, you know what that means, Lauren?
What?
It means I'm going to have to try harder.
Oh, please don't say bad jokes.
Hey, Lauren.
What?
Have you heard about those new corduroy pillows?
No.
They're making headlines everywhere. Didn't like that one, huh?
It wasn't funny.
It was very funny. You know, maybe you don't like the joke because you weren't involved in it as much as some jokes. So let's try this. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
I eat mop.
I eat my poo.
Ew, Lauren, you eat your poo. You got to tell that one to the boys.
No. They'll just become annoying with it.
Well, I don't know what's naughty or neat in your own poo, but. Okay. Enough of the jokes. We got to get down to some serious business here.
Okay.
Okay. So. There were so many people in town for this fucking eclipse that when I tried to go to Duff's on Saturday, there was an hour waiting list.
Oh, no, how terrible. Why didn't you just get takeout and go home?
It's not the same, Lauren. You can't take Duff's wings out. It's not the same. I ended up having to go without Duff's.
Ah.
Yeah, it was... hang on. I had to go the whole week without eating Duff's wings.
Well, there'll be another Saturday soon, and you can have Duff wings then.
Yeah, and the wings will come to the table, and I'll be like... It's like angels, Lauren.
I think we have a listener who would disagree with that, but... Yeah.
Who would that be?
Well, a listener that might think you're being blasphemous.
Oh, he knows I'm blasphemous. He, the great father, who's quite a fan of the show, loves the show, says that just that he doesn't understand how that Lauren is so nasty and obnoxious and mean and rotten and a bully.
No, he doesn't.
No, but you remember that woman who said you were a bully?
Yes, I do remember that. But then that was the kind of the episode you were at. You were being absolutely xenophobic.
How was I being xenophobic?
The sheep things. You call me a sheep. Stop it. Now, stop it now.
I don't know why it's xenophobic just to point out that you all have sheep in your homes.
We do not.
I see them right in your living room. See, there he is.
I'm not even in my living room, Brian. Don't even have my camera on. So you're just not, this, it's just lies.
Do you hear him? I hear him. Sarah, did you hear the sheep there? Sarah's on Team Lauren here, and I don't like that.
Even Cleo's on my side, and she's going to bite you when you're sleeping now for me.
Probably. Oh, yeah. But running a little late today, because I was co-hosting a friend of ours, Jonathan Steele, in the Crazy Train radio show. I was asked to go on and co-host an episode with him that any of our listeners can look up Crazy Train Radio. And the episode I just recorded, we were interviewing the great Felissa Rose, the horror movie actress, absolute icon, star of the original Sleepaway Camp. And it was fun. So I just got back from doing that. And I said, hey, Felissa, it's been great talking to you, but got a jet because I got to go talk to Lauren. See how much I love you, Lauren?
No, you didn't. That's lies. Terrible lies.
What? What part? I was just talking to Felissa Rose.
I know, but you didn't say, oh, I've got to go now because I've got to talk to Lauren. You didn't say that.
No, I didn't. But what did I do as soon as I was done talking to her?
You went out for a cigar.
Well, first I pooped. I did not.
Why did
they... I didn't. I just wanted to get the reaction.
Just wanted
the reaction. Someone did point out, and this was not an email to us or anything in relation to us, but I was listening, not watching, but listening to a different podcast the other day. And I don't even know what podcast it was, to be honest, because it was a guest that I was trying, that I was thinking about booking for our show, and I saw that they were on some other show. So I was, you know, listening to it to see how they were as guests. And the host of that show said that things you're not supposed to talk about on podcasts are politics and poop.
Yes, and you just talk about them all the time.
Yeah, so apparently you're not supposed to talk about poop on a podcast.
No, and we're going to retire that segment of you talking about all things toilet and bathroom buddy, please, for the goodness sake and the love of my sanity, please.
Oh, I can talk about something, all things toilets, though. Not about poop, though. Well, it's kind of about poop. So I just bought my mother this little game to play, and it's like, it's tiddlywinks with poops that you try to flip into a toilet. Isn't that wonderful?
I bet she loved it.
She did. She says it's fantastic. You put those little poops right there and you flip them and try to get them in the toilet. It's tough, though. It's not easy.
You know, she's causing mayhem in the day room with that now.
Oh, probably. Well, she doesn't go in the room with those bats. Do you think she socializes with the bats?
To cause mayhem and destruction, of course.
Possibly, but she's got tiddlywinks poop in her. First one is this great. It's like this big, not big, but it's like a tabletop toilet, and it comes with a little plunger on it, and you roll the dice, and however many things come up on the dice, you have to plunge that many times, and at random, a turd flies out the top of it, and you have to catch the turd. And whoever catches the turd wins that round. I've never once caught the turd, Lauren.
I should hope you have not.
My brother is so good at catching the turd. It's all those years of playing baseball. That poop flies out of that toilet, and it comes out fast. And he catches it every time.
Good for him.
You don't want to talk about that anymore, huh?
No, I don't really want to talk about all things scatological.
All right. Apparently, they don't number two in Wales. But how was your week, Lauren?
It's going well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You didn't have an eclipse, though. You didn't have any wings. I don't know how you could say it's been a good week.
Well, it has been a good week. Corey and Theo are back in school, and when they're back in school, it's always a good week.
Oh. Now, are they back in school? Do they have summer break?
Yes, they go back to school. They have, at the end of May, they have Whitsun, a week off for Whitsun, and then they go back for like a month and a half, and then they're off for 6 weeks over the summer from mid-July to the beginning of September.
Okay, so it's not that different than in America.
No, we have more I think we have the same amount of holidays in principle, but they're split up over the year. For example, they have 1 week in October, 2 weeks over Christmas, 1 week in February, 2 weeks for Easter, then a week off late spring, and then summer holidays, then mid-July.
I don't get it. When I was in school, we didn't have any holidays. We had to go to school uphill, in snow, both ways. No holidays.
I'm sure you did have holidays, Brian.
They changed us to our desks. And if we didn't get perfect scores, we failed.
And yeah, you entered the school and 5 years old, and you only saw your family again when you turned 18.
Well, yeah, because we were busy working. You know, we had to go to work then. And and to get to work, you know, you had to walk uphill both ways in the snow with no shoes. And you worked in a shoe factory, which made it even worse.
Yeah.
So all the bosses at the shoe factory laughed at us. If we were lucky, we could put milk cartons on our feet. That was it, Lauren.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, that's America.
Goodness, no. We're going to have complaints about that now because you added that's America at the end.
Because that's America. Oh, you know, I had the strangest dream last night.
Oh, goodness.
I did. It wasn't dirty, Lauren. Don't say it like that.
No, I don't know if I want to listen to what your dream was.
You just what?
I don't know if I want to listen to what your dream was.
It was really weird. I dreamed I was a muffler. And I woke up exhausted. No.
I got it, but it wasn't funny.
I thought it was funny. All right. If you don't think that's funny, maybe we'll skip that and we'll go right on to, why don't you clear your throat? Since it was supposed to be your turn to introduce the show, and give me a good day in history.
Okay, I will.
Today in history.
That was a pretty good one.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, so what you got for me, Lauren? What's your day in history?
I've got the 9th of April, 1865. Confederate General Robert E. Lee surrenders his army to Lieutenant General Ulysses S. Grant at Appomattox Courthouse in Virginia, effectively ending the United States Civil War after 4 years. I like Ulysses Grant.
Yeah, but Robert E. Lee broke a musket on his knee and 1,000 pieces shattered on the... Sorry, did you ever... Never mind. Cheesy horror films again. My brain is filled with them. Probably get a copyright strike just for singing that.
Yeah. It's a good day, though. I like it.
They're in the UK, don't you? Do you guys study it in school?
The American Civil War?
Yeah.
The causes of it, yes, but not in depth.
You know what you would love? If you do get to America at some point, traveling up and down the coast to all the Civil War battle sites?
I've got somebody who will do that for me. My friend Jen, her dad is a Union reenactor, and he has offered to take me to the battle grounds.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's so fascinating and so frightening. And
I mean, I do know that one thing about Gettysburg is that sometimes if it rains hard,
tons of people there trying to catch EVPs of dead.
Yeah, there's that. But there's also if it rains a lot and there's movement of the ground, then, you know, a skeleton has been known to pop up.
Yeah, there's lots of them there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've told this story on the show before, but probably not in a long time. And every time the Civil War comes up, this comes into my head. And if you'll indulge me, I'm not even trying to be funny, that my memory of the Civil War, not that I was there, obviously, Lauren, I'm not that old. Stop laughing. Growing up where I did, right around the corner from where I lived, my house as a child, was a man named Mr. Bellinger. And Mr. Bellinger had a barn built in the back of his house, which is very weird in the middle of a little canal city to see a barn, because there's no, it's not like Wales with all the sheep. There's like no, the only animals are dogs, cats, and the occasional, like, you know, birds. That's it. But he had a barn built in the behind his house. And inside the barn was the world's largest collection of Civil War memorabilia. Sadly, when he passed away, the whole collection was separated, which is a tragedy, because it was a museum in and of itself. He loved showing off the Civil War memorabilia and teaching about it to all the kids in the neighborhood. And we would go and knock on his door and, you know, Mr. Bellinger, can we go into the barn? And he called it Bellinger's Hidden Barn. Oh. And he would come outside with the keys and he would open the barn door and he would turn the light on, but he would stop you at the door. And before you walked in, and it gives me a chill just saying it, he would always say, "All the ghosts of all the men that fought and died in the Civil War live in this barn. Be respectful." And then he would take you through the collection.
That's a lovely way to think about it.
Yeah, and it was just amazing that this is, you know, you're talking about a priceless collection. I mean, apparently when it was busted up and sold off at auctions all over the place, there was millions and millions of dollars. But he never profited off it. He just had the world's largest collection. He kept it in a barn, and, you know, he would love showing it to anybody who knocked at the door that wanted to see it. And that's, you know, whenever I think of the Civil War, that's what I think of, is Mr. Bellinger and the Hidden Barn. I really miss that. And you're going back more than, you know, this is well over 40 years ago when I would go through the barn. But I remember like it was yesterday.
Amazing. Such a special and unique memory.
Yeah, it was something. And see, I didn't even throw any poop jokes in there.
No, it's nice when you're serious, actually. Very nice. Now let's hear your one about fancy rounders or some such.
Hey, believe it or not, my day in history today is about fancy rounders. Sort of. But today in history, April 9th, 1925, the most famous baseball player that ever lived, the one and only George Herman Babe Ruth, at the height of his fame and career, was rushed to the hospital with a mysterious condition that was labeled the bellyache heard round the world. Newspapers actually reported that he was dead.
Wow.
But he wasn't. You know, he just went to the hospital, got out of the hospital, and, you know, the rest is history because he's Babe Ruth. I mean, even in the UK, where they don't watch baseball, you know all about Babe Ruth. I mean, you know who he is.
I know who he is, yes.
Yeah. The greatest player of all time. And, yep.
Did they ever find out what the condition was? Brian?
Do you remember what it's actually diagnosed as? Yep. Oh, are you there?
Sorry, you cut out. I didn't. Did they find out what the condition was?
Yeah, it was an abscess.
Oh, ow. Oh, ow. Oh, those hurt.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, he'd been suffering from, you know, high fevers during spring training. He collapsed a couple times. But, you know, he was hospitalized, had the surgery. Some people thought it was influenza. Other people were claiming it was venereal disease. Like I said, other people said he was dead. Some people said it was a bellyache because he ate too many hot dogs. So, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know how that's, the press is still like that.
They are.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, he made a full recovery.
Did.
And he's Babe Ruth. I mean, he's the greatest.
He absolutely is.
But I like the hot dog story best of all. I like to think it was because he ate like 1,000 hot dogs. Wouldn't that have been great?
Well, if he'd have eaten like 1,000 hot dogs from the cart in London, you could definitely see how he got bellyache.
Oh, why do you bring that up, Lauren? Listen, the most grotesque thing in the world is a London hot dog from a hot dog cart in London.
I don't know. Yeah, everybody doesn't. Nobody eats from them, Brian, except for tourists.
There were lots of people eating from them. It was busy. That's why we went there. We're like, look, everyone's there eating that shit. Literally, it turned out to be shit. Oh. I remember I bit into it, and I just made this face and I spit it out, and my brother said, what? And I said, there's something wrong with it. And he said, like, what? I said, like the taste. And he laughed thinking I was joking, and he bit into it and instantly spit it out. Oh, and I thought you fuckers were famous for your sausages.
Not really.
Speaking of that, I gotta ask you this.
What?
Do you in Wales as well eat beans and sausages for breakfast?
Yeah, if we're having a fried breakfast, well, if you're having a fry up, then yes, beans or tomatoes make an appearance.
Yeah, beans are not breakfast food.
They're very delicious as a breakfast food, though.
They're not breakfast food, Lauren.
I mean, yeah.
No, they're not.
It can be. I mean, anything could be a breakfast food if you look at it the right way.
Yeah, I guess. Do you ever eat breakfast for dinner?
It depends. Maybe sometimes. I have had cereal for dinner, now, you know, if I felt like it.
Like, I love every once in a while making, like, an omelette for dinner.
Omelettes are good.
Yeah, omelettes are delicious. But we can't talk about this because I'm going to get hungry if we do. And besides that, we've got one hell of an interview coming up, Lauren. You know how excited I was just to do this interview.
I know you're very excited and had been for weeks. It was really nice to see you so excited.
And what amazed me even more, because I was such a fan of this performer. And, you know, over the weeks I've been sending you clips of her work and her performances, and you became quite a fan yourself.
I did.
And I was just so amazed that as much as I admire her as a performer, I admire even more as a person now, because she was so, so lovely and charming and eloquent and just, she's wonderful. She's great. I can't say enough positive things about her. What about you? You could say positive things about her now.
She was very sweet, very knowledgeable, and very passionate about her work. And I think, you know, it's a great episode and everybody is going to love it. It's a little bit different to what we do. And that's always a good thing sometimes to do different things. But it's lovely to see somebody who knows the history so well and is knowledgeable about it and makes it their own thing, because now she's carved her own niche in history of clowning, and she will be remembered equally as the greats.
Absolutely. I couldn't have said it better, Lauren. So I'm not even going to try to say it any better. I am going to just fire up the magic interview box.
It's the magic interview box.
And you know what? I didn't let you say the beginning, so I'm going to let you flip the switch. Lauren, you know how excited I am for this show. I've been excited for this show for over a month. I've been talking about it. I've been hinting at it. I have not looked forward to a show like this. This is like 180 episodes and at least 175 episodes. No offense to any previous guests. I love y'all, but I am so excited because, you know, my love of history of show business and in particular sideshow. I was watching a documentary about English music hall performers, and on the screen popped this clown. And this clown was talking about how some of these performers don't get the respect and credit and history that they deserve. And all I could think of was, I need that clown on my show now, damn it. And after a little hunting, I found, in my opinion, and this is me, but I think anybody who will see her perform, my second favorite clown in history, the greatest living performer I have seen, just the most amazing clown. I'm telling you that you're going to get a lot of praise in this show, because I have just been showing everybody. In my cigar shop, I keep showing people clips of your work. And I am so thrilled you're here. Welcome to Transatlantic History Ramblings. And it is so weird to see you without makeup on. And it's going to be even weirder to hear your voice, because the clown doesn't speak.
No.
Welcome. How are you?
I'm well. I'm good. I'm just recovering from the Easter period in the UK. And I've been in Wales during the Easter period teaching.
You're in Wales?
In Wales, yeah. In Swansea with a company teaching a clown school that we run in. Well, we did like a tour of the libraries in that area. So I'm well. I'm nice and rested and had an inspirational week.
It's now it's not fair, I realize. I'm being ganged up on because I have two people in Swansea against one guy in Buffalo. But you know what? I just got to watch the eclipse. You didn't. Yeah, it was real. The eclipse was one over Buffalo.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, total eclipse. You know, it was once in a 125-year type of thing. Really cloudy. We couldn't see shit.
Oh, no.
But I reached out to you as soon as I found any contact information for you and said, you spoke so eloquently about, and it was little Titch that did not get the respect in history that a performer of his magnitude, I shouldn't say stature, but his magnitude deserved. And I realized at that point, this is someone who cares about the history and tradition of the art. But in all my research, I found out you don't come from a clowning history.
Well, I mean, a clowning history is kind of a complex thing. There's, you know, lots of different people that have become clowns for lots of different reasons throughout history. And I think how I found clown was, you know, not through a family in show business or anything, but I have a lot of like interests, and that has grown from like lots of like, you know, we were talking about Little Titch, so that's kind of like a vaudeville musical period where, you know, something that represents a clown. He was an important person, but clowning as a history, I think most people just think it's, you know, the classic circus clown, the big ears, white face, which I do look quite like. So it's kind of,
yeah, it's I titled the episode Clowning, the World's Second Oldest Profession, because clowning really is the origins of show business. I mean, we can date it back to like 2400 BC.
Well, I think that sort of, if you're looking at clowning through like history and you're looking at like periods, you're looking at like ancient clowning was, you know, very close to sort of religion in lots of ways. And the actual like sermons and clowning, this idea of sacred clowning, there was like that within sort of Egyptian times. And you're looking at that very like very first kind of character that was second to the person that did the talking, you know, you've got that second character. So I think like that ancient clowning is really, really like, because we have no record of it, we just look at it and like the modern world goes, oh, well, that's their clown character. But that is actually something you see pop up within like humanity, show business, storytelling, entertainment. As soon as we started entertaining each other, that kind of figure of the clown was born. And I think, you know, you can trace it, you know, like you said, back to sort of 240 BC. And it's a long time ago.
Almost as old as me.
Nearly.
Yeah. You know, my hair's grayer, but, you know, I
Well, nearly as not as old as me. You know, I consider myself, you know, like a young woman, and I've been working as a clown for nearly 20 years now. And like as what I would consider a clown for 20 years. And I've only got this like tiny minute knowledge of the contemporary clowns around me, a like block of history that's gone before me. So it's kind of, I feel sometimes with the clowning, it makes you feel ancient, because it is, you know, it's kind of this, you're taking on a character, you're taking on a job, like you said, you know, a second most important job. It's kind of this idea that this character, and we've had a fascination with this character, what we call clown, or we term fool or buffoon, and it, how it pops up through history in like literature and show business. It's fantastic. It's interesting to look at it as really as a sort of reflection of man and how we've dealt with like society and civilization. You know, if you look at what the clowns were doing in each sort of section of civilization, you get a real grasp of the like sort of socioeconomic idea of the like landscape you're in.
And in America now, they sell hamburgers or scare the shit out of people.
Yeah, that's true. It's taken a sort of new form. So, you know, they sell hamburgers with it. In this country, they've recently used it to call the politicians idiotic. There was a whole press campaign where they put clown, like, you know, costumes on the politicians. So, you know, you see it now. It's very much a very cliche pastiche kind of.
Have you seen our last president? I'm just saying, you know, he wears more makeup than Dot does.
On a normal day, probably, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you mean your last president? I mean, he could be your future president as well.
Ah, don't say that, Lauren. Don't say that. I'm a New Yorker. I don't want to hear that. What I do want to hear is, why is the respect of clowning so different in the UK than it is in America? I mean, in America, when you say a clown, no one even realizes it's a broad spectrum. They just think Bozo the Clown or Ronald McDonald or Pennywise from It. You know, that's the only thing Americans think of.
I think that's more or less the world over, to be honest. I've been conducting like a little opening introduction to a lot of the workshops I've run over the last 10 years. And I've taken these out to sort of non-show business communities. So everywhere in the UK, especially like rural Wales, we've done a lot of work there. And just asking groups of children and adults to name a clown. Like, do you know a clown? Where could you see a clown? And even over the last 10 years that I've done it, that response has diminished. You know, maybe 10 years ago, I'd get Charlie Chaplin, Krusty the Clown. I would get, you know, Pennywise. I might get a local clown or two, Mr. Tumble in the UK. But really now it has just descended into they don't really see a clown. It's mostly the scary clown thing. Kids have that projection of it. So it's just, maybe it's the same in America as it is in the UK. It's very out of fashion within sort of the mainstream culture. So if you're talking about, you know, people that are everyday consuming, you know, television, pop culture, and even just, you know, mainstream art. But you do find in the UK there is definitely an interest within theatrical communities and art communities wider of this idea and this legend of the clown, especially sort of my generation, you know, 30s to 40s adults, because we saw the sort of dying era of that in the 90s. So amongst a lot of performers in the UK, clowning is still taught as a very, and I think in Europe specifically, clowning is still very much taught on a lot of the like theatre and art, like degrees and things. So it has a sort of slightly higher prestige. However, if you want to actually find the sort of cutting edge of clowning, actually at the moment is in New York. So it's kind of, and it has been for maybe the last sort of 20 years, I reckon.
Yeah, but not Buffalo, New York.
I don't know, because I don't know New York. All I know is, like, you know, when I see shows that are out, that are like pushing boundaries of contemporary clown, or like, you know, working with it as an art form, rather than it being a marketing gimmick or like a wholesale character in a costume shop, that is coming out of, like, you know, a lot of studios working in New York. So it's kind of interesting having that like undercurrent in America. You know, clowning's something that they contributed to massively. If you look at the history of clowning and where it, you know, where it developed in Europe, how it moved through to like America with the circus, you know, the clowning character as we developed it in Western Europe through Commedia dell'arte and mime and pantomime, and what we had as this like stock character by, you know, Joseph Grimaldi's age, as that went through into circuses in America, the brothers and Barnum and Bailey took that character and made it a stock American example. And you saw, you know, the like modernism around clown. The Americans did better than anybody else. They found people from all over the world and went, come to our circus, we will teach you to be a master clown. You know, you're walking in the footsteps of some of the greatest living legends within like circus clowning. And they kind of did what they always do, and they did it to death, you know. You get 46 and you're looking at like the birth of Bozo the clown, and even the name Bozo is already starting to have like annoying connotations. And you have this American style kids TV personality, and you start to sell things through it, and we lose our real life working clowns. And they're replaced with, you know, Ronald McDonald's, you know, straight out of that Bozo experience. It's interesting to watch like how America's responded to that and then gone, oh, but actually as an art form and a physicality, we're now bringing it into our stand-up comedy, we're bringing it into our sketch comedy. Our physical theatre is, and contemporary dance is using it really, really well at the moment. So
what I think America should take more credit for this than they ever do is that, you know, the English music hall performers that would eventually become the early film performers, I think Chaplin and Stan Laurel in particular, who was Chaplin's understudy in the music hall.
Yeah.
When they went into film, these American clowns dominated. And they just had such an impact. And yet in America, we don't think of them as clowns. We don't look at, you know, this great silent tradition. No one says, you know, Harold Lloyd was a clown, or Buster Keaton was a clown, or Harpo Marx, my alter ego was a clown. And they're the epitome of clowning.
Yeah, totally. You are looking at that sort of dying era, like the golden era of clown, and people like Charlie Chaplin moving from circus to music hall. So they're moving from circus to music hall, from music hall to the silent film industry. And, you know, you're looking at performers, especially in America, you know, they had a whole different experience with clowning and circus and animals to we did in the, you know, Western Europe. And they, because of the, you know, logistics of the land, you had so much more space, you were able to put on so much more spectacle. And, you know, a lot of clowning that went into music hall from circus was a lot more acrobatic. You've got rodeo clowns, you've got people who are so good at doing stunts, you know, they've ridden on horseback and can move around a horse like they're broken and stand up at the end. And these people, when the silent film industry hit, they were too big. Their acrobatics were too big for music hall. Like, you're looking at, you know, Buster Keaton, for instance, how he sort of saw stunts was on that great American scale. And you couldn't have got that in an English circus or a European circus, because already there was limited space for travel. Land was, and border control was a lot more, you know, locked down in the UK. And I mean, certain points we couldn't even, you know, put theatre on in the UK. I think they closed the UK theatres for a good sort of 18 years at one point, just to shut up the political impact of it. But it's, I think America has like, homed and provided a big space for a lot of clowns. You know, you're looking at, like, you know, your original sort of Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin. They're not, you know, you don't see them as American. They're seen as worldwide. And they're also not seen in the clowning tradition, even though they've come from that sort of world. But it's again, it's that thing of this character and how it's actually portrayed for like the time that it's in. It will be a reflection of the, like, of what's going on. So, like, seeing Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton being these like foolish characters that are so innocent in these like industrial landscapes that are going up around them, and them dealing with trains and dealing with, like, you know, tourists, and, you know, all this sort of things that were modern day issues, that's still that epitome of a lot of what, you know, the clown was, is that commentary on social like oddities. You know, they're looking at things that we are doing as we're becoming more civilized, or we're becoming more modern, and going, wow, that's mental, you know, like that happened. You know, it's like that train is doing this, and I walk on the side of it? I don't know, I've never seen a train. And it's always that clown sort of idea that you're not sure how something's happening. You might, you know, it's not being simple in terms of knowing nothing. It's being having a simple outlook in a lot of ways, that, you know, you have this freedom to explore something. And you can see that in, you know, all of the sort of early solo clown in silent films like Buster and Keaton. And then, of course, you get your Laurel and Hardy, and you get your direct reference to that, like, clowning duo, which was so, so, like, important in the, like, in circus and vaudeville. It's sort of the August character and the white face and the August, and how they interact with each other, you know, developed in, like, European Parisian circus. And then that was sort of taken and became a stock duo character to every, like, film that you then see for the next, any, like, you know, duo film that is about two people for the next, you know, couple of centuries. That's come from this, like, one device in clowning that was sort of created in the like very, very early 1900s. But it's, yeah, it's America provided a great stage, especially with Hollywood and the film industry, as well as the space and circuses. So the clowns that developed there have always had a lot of freedom.
And what made that work, at least for me, even as a child and now as an old man, the charm and almost childlike naivete of a Stan Laurel,
yeah,
that the true clown has that. I was actually describing your act to someone recently, and I said, when I watch anything she does, I see Stan Laurel, Harpo Marx, and Julieta Messina from La Strada as Gelsomina in her performance. There's this charm, innocence, but a little cheekiness like Harpo had, the little wink and a nod, but there's that innocence that Dot Cotton the clown has. And it's in the eyes. Very few clowns do it right. It's,
I mean, that's
an expression, you know, you get.
I can't say that's not cultivated. You know, all those people are, you know, all those films and references there are people that I've studied as, you know, I come from a dance background. So my background was, you know, my mum and my grandma took me to ballet, and then, you know, that wasn't quite daredevil enough. So I ended up in ice skating. That was a bit more daredevil, and I got to rush around, jump around and be stupid with it. And I could be a bit more clumsy because everybody was falling over. So I could do like some of the graceful stuff very well, but when I fell over, it was fine. So I then spent the next, you know, years of my life learning how to fall over very well. Very, very well, because it's the only thing you can guarantee when you're training to be a figure skater, that is that you can fall over and that you're in the middle, a tiny person in the middle of a huge ice rink, and you've got to somehow make eye contact with three people that are judges and make them watch everything you're doing. So you get big facial expressions and you learn how to fall over. And coming out of that, I had no idea what I was going to do or what I was, you know, really interested in, but I was really good at falling over. So it kind of made this full like step towards clown in a couple of years for me. And you know, that came with a lot of research and a lot of like me going, hang on, there's, you know, not that many females doing this, and females that are doing it have never really done it in a very traditional sense. So, you know, I, you know, watched and watched and watched, obsessed with Charlie Chaplin as, you know, him being a ballet dancer that then became a clumsy performer. But the fact that he had such poetic control of his body meant that he was able to make it look effortless that he fell through something. And, you know, that kind of same thing with Keaton, and the kind of innocence and the being able to keep the deadpan face throughout everything that he did. It's like, you know, a building falls down around him, and it's like, oh, that could happen. That's fine. And it's just brave. You know, it's an
innocent. And for real, it really, yeah, fell. I mean, that was a real side of a house that fell. There was no CGI or anything, folks. And it was real. It could have killed him if he didn't get his mathematics right.
Yep. And he knew that, but he also kind of, if you're looking at that, like, we see it as sort of innocence in his face, but the actual courage to not know in front of people, the courage to, in a way, make a fool of yourself. But it's not making a fool of yourself, because you actually have that power to be inside and outside of the action. So I think that's what makes a clown more important than any other character within that sort of storytelling framework, is that it's one of the only characters that's able to look at an audience and go, I'm in on this too, you know. And like, you get that in Charlie Chaplin's winks at the camera, and you get that at Keaton's deadpan looks, when, and that lets you in, and that they are the only characters, even within silent film history, that have that nuance with an audience. And that's why they become so magical, and it becomes so intoxicating in a lot of ways. So I, as somebody who's trained as a clown, it's like when people say things like that to me, I'm like, I'd love to say that I naturally had it, but it is something that you start adopting and looking into and ways of training and how you put yourself through that as a clown is.
I understand that, but I also believe, and I don't think you would ever admit this, but there is something natural about it because so few people can do it. And I've seen so many people try to do it, and you nail it, that the perfect example, there was the video you did about getting a clown for Christmas. Clowns aren't just for Christmas. There's shots of you looking in the window, and it is pure Stan Laurel, and it's an expression that other clowns just can't get. I've seen people try to do it, and you just nail it. There's something special about that. That, yeah, you train to do it, but I trained for years. I still can't hit a curveball, so.
Yeah, I think, you know, there will have been a natural talent in it. But for me, that personally came from taking myself out to Europe for, like, I sort of did it for 3 to 4 years. And then I've sporadically done it and worked as a street performer because I felt that, I mean, I was awful when I started. I had no idea, you know, what I was doing. Once I'd got somebody's attention, how to keep it, how to not let adrenaline control what you're doing and like actually stay calm in a situation. And there's no way you can actually like get that naturally. That is like a bank of audience observation that you can only get from being in front of an audience in an interactive environment. And that is kind of really like, I am not a touchy-feely clown. I will not like actually make a move to ever touch an audience or make an audience do anything. I've always had this thing where I will let the audience come and interact with me and see how that goes and try not to promote actual touch because I feel like it spoils the magic of the actual performance if you're touching. But some clowns do, and there's very much like, you know, you see a lot of clowns in Europe moving people around. But I felt that it was important to actually have eye contact with people and being stood in the street full of thousands of people and making sure that you can make 10 people in the street that are watching you all at the same time feel like there's something important to them. It becomes this bank of observation, and you mirror people's facial expressions in order to get them to interact with you. And if you do it enough over years and years and years of doing it, you kind of have this stock of faces that you're able to link upon. And one of the things I teach in my clown school, like even with like small children, is warming up the face, moving the face around and getting them ready to go from like a very sad face to an angry face. And actually having that discipline over expression is something like when I was very early learning to do it, spending a lot of time in a mirror. I think lots of kids do it now with the phone, with the Instagram and the filming themselves and spending lots of time making the faces and things. But it's definite.
Now, I have to go off topic for a second, because if I don't, there's a friend of mine who's gonna kill me. My friend Mark is obsessed. I mean, obsessed with Harry Styles. And when I told him I was going to be interviewing you and that you were in the Harry Styles music video and showed it to him, he freaked out like a girl at a Beatles concert. So he wanted me to ask you what Harry was like to work with. And he actually specifically asked, and this is going to be bizarre, what car did he drive onto the set? Not that you would have any idea, but...
So I think if you say you're working with somebody, there is an implication that you get a chance to have an interaction with somebody. And I've done quite a lot of like film sets and things like that where you're going and you're working for an artist who is actually also working for somebody else, which is the director. So often, you know, you go to a film set and you're working with the director as much as the artist is working with the director, and how that artist, you know, responds in that environment often says a lot about them personally, but you don't really ever get to interact with them. I think having been on a few of those and seen people, I could safely say that Harry Styles is probably one of the sweetest people that I've ever seen working on a film set, considering what they had him do in that video shoot and who like was there. Like, you know, he didn't really interact very much, but he was very, very sweet, very, very nice, very, very polite to all of us when we had to interact with him. And then in his downtime, he played football with the two little boys that were the kids of the Circus Santos that they'd actually rented. And their dads were doing the actual high wire act, which he was then superimposed on to make it look like it was Harry Styles. And he was just a really nice, sweet, lovely person. I didn't see what he drove into, but he had a very big trailer where he was having all of his hair and makeup done, and we all had to go in the big circus top. So there was a cast of about sort of 40 to 50 circus
females. And if anyone needed the makeup trailer, it was you.
No, we were all in a big production line, and they set big big top for us, and we were in a production line with lots of people pulling our hairs and stickings and stuff, and he just came out in lots of different spangly outfits, so I imagine he had to have that done in privacy, but he was very nice.
Now, this just reminded me, led me to another direction. You've been doing the clown for 20 plus years, you said.
I think maybe, like, if I would say, yeah, I'd say I've been working and sort of interested in clowning for 20 plus years. But if you want to say, when did I actually start, actually, this is my job, this is how I make money, I think it's sort of 15 to 17 years I've been.
So how long does it take you to put the face on?
The record is 6 minutes.
Whoa! 6 minutes.
Record of 6 minutes, which I've had to put it on in such a rush, in such a few circumstances. I've had to put it on the tube, I've had to put it on in cars, you know, toilets, and like, you know, the record was I had to do it in 6 minutes on the tube, and it's quite, yeah. Which is breaking number one clown rules, that you're not supposed to put your makeup on in front of audiences, but I kind of, I don't know, for the last 15 years, I've been walking around in makeup, doing everything in makeup, you know, eating in restaurants in makeup, in between shows, you know, shopping in makeup, getting the tube in makeup, getting on flights, taking the makeup off, putting the flight back on, putting it on in taxis. So it's kind of it's normal for me now.
Where did what was your inspiration for the clown face? I mean, was there anybody in particular? Because it's a distinct look, and I absolutely love it. With the small lips, the accentuating the eyes, so you can get that expression, which is, like I said, that's the thing that always floored me when I first started watching your performances, is that you get that expression just down like no other clown does.
I think makeup for me started very much in a sense that when I first started working, I thought I wanted to be more like a mime, because I felt that that was a little bit more sort of palatable to sort of where I was working, which was like beaches in Spain and France. So I kind of went with that very kind of classic white face. If this was the initial makeup, was literally the white face, and I couldn't do lipstick very well, so I was going for that sort of geisha lip, and that's been the same from the beginning. And then eventually I sort of came back, and it stayed that for a long time, and then I came back to the UK and I sort of ended up making a clown nose, which ended up being the same nose, sort of the same mold I've been using for all of that time working with a nurse. So I made the nurse based on like how I kind of felt that it was time I got a nurse and see how it went. And I didn't want to, I found from working in the mime makeup that I was really silly, but people didn't take what I was doing. I wanted to be taken really seriously. And as a mime, I was too pretty. And if I got a nice big fat red nose on the end of my face, it would distract away from that and actually maybe accentuate other things. And I'm not actually very good at makeup as a person, as a female identifying human being. I struggle with putting lipstick on and things without feeling kind of like a bit garish. So it kind of became a way of developing the makeup to almost experiment with performance and experiment with clown and experiment with loss of identity. And then it was really very, very simple makeup. So it was those lips, the red nose, and I had no eye makeup. I had no eyebrows at all because I shaved them off and I had no hair either at the time. Because I was wearing lots of wigs. I've grown my own clown hair now, so it's good. But eventually I moved in with a collection of drag queens in East London at the time. And they were like, why have you not got any eyebrows? Where's your eyebrow? Don't you wear blusher? And I was like, I don't understand. And it took a collection of very, very like dear to me drag queens to actually put some eye makeup on me. And they went, oh, you do it like this. And I basically took a picture of my face and I've just copied the same eye makeup for the last 10 years and I haven't changed it. So I've just, that's why I can do it in 6 minutes. It's because it is like, muscle memory.
I'm glad you brought up the drag queens, which I say, especially in America, drag is a form of clown.
It is, yeah. I mean, I've been very lucky. I've been on tour with Bianca Del Rio in the UK when she came to the UK a couple of years ago after just winning the RuPaul's Drag Race. She said to her promoter that she wanted the best clown they had in the UK. And I was very lucky that I actually lived with the drag queen who was promoting her shows, so they got me. And I was really, I think we did about 6 shows together in the UK, which was so interesting to listen to, that perspective of how clown developed in America and actually, it's been the handle of it taken on very much by the like drag identifying community. And that sort of caricature of person that's able to make a fool of themselves in order to promote some sort of reflection of society. Bianca Del Rio, I find, is like, very inspiring as a person that does that. But
well, drag is under attack in America right now. I don't know if it's covered in the UK or on the news, but I mean, it is
under attack in the UK as well. It's terrible here. What happens here? There was a drag queen story time in Swansea and
the Welsh Millennium Centre also the same thing.
And it was horrible. They had this group of people who say that they're protecting children, and they turned up, they FaceTime lived and took videos of them challenging the staff, and they made horrible allegations towards the staff. They were calling the staff paedophiles.
Oh yeah.
It was horrible. There's very little that venues can do because the groups are very clever and they know how to work to not get caught and everything. But it's horrible what happens there. And a lot of these venues are deciding not to do it anymore because it's putting staff at risk.
Well, here too, it's not only people protesting it like that, but I mean, we have actual groups of literal neo-Nazis showing up to protect society. We have city councils and states banning drag, trying to criminalize it here. And I try to tell people, you realize drag is clown. It's clowning. And when I say that, I get attacked all, like, for even defending it.
Yeah, I mean, I've had similar things in Wales and in the UK as well. I work at the Welsh and Lenzium Centre. We have the same thing, the drag story time, and it was met with, like, quite a lot of issue. And one of the big things that I brought up was, like, you've all grown up watching pantomime dames. You know, it's a tradition in the UK that, you know, the year at Christmas, the pantomime dames are either women in drag or men in drag. You know, that's very much the character. And it's fine for them to tell stories and be performers from any kind of situation, but it's not okay for it to be, you know, directly in a classroom where, you know, you're not honoring traditions of performance you grew up with, even if what you're
because it's not about that anymore, it's just pure culture war, which means that's right, we should all be attacking the clowns, right?
I think with that, though, in Wales, because I don't know if it was Ada, because I know the one in Swansea was Ada HD, they get really personal and they seem to enjoy attacking Ada themselves. This isn't about it, it gets so personal that it stops being about drag, it becomes about the person behind the makeup as well.
Oh yeah.
It's just horrible. And the length that the venues have to go to protect not just their staff, but the children seeing the performance. And Ada's very good as well by explaining the story and explaining what's going to happen.
Yeah.
But you get weird things like people block booking tickets to try and stop people from going. And you'll get them attacking people for taking their children there. And it's just horrible.
Yeah, hopefully you don't go down the same route we did and try to criminalize it, which is what they're doing in America in certain places, is literally criminalizing it.
No,
horrible. And
we're quite lucky because most of the councils are liberal and the government of Wales is a liberal government. It's a socialist government, so that is unlikely to ever happen.
Yeah, we said that too about 10 years ago.
But the thing is it's different here. If the council that's in charge makes all the decisions, it's unlike America where you've got the House of Representatives and you can have that balance shift. It doesn't quite happen like that here
yet, thankfully.
And I think
it never does.
And I think, well, because clowning has such an attachment to the industrial history of Wales, that's unlikely to happen because, you know, the miners used to put on pantomimes. They used to dress up in drag to amuse each other down the mines as well. So it's something that is part of the DNA. And a lot of Welsh language comedy is drag comedy. And I went to a Welsh school and one of our school treats was there's a Welsh entertainer called Mickey Plum, and he had a clown, Plumbo, and he always used to come to our school. He was the best treat ever. So I just don't think it would ever happen here.
No, I think we're kind of, especially like Wales and what is like kind of half of the public are split into a sort of like, you know, demographic where there is very liberal. It is, you know, people have very creative and, you know, accepting ways, like especially with things like clowning and drag. You're looking at a community that is actually very friendly and accepting in general. And then there's always the other half, the other fraction that is more conservative. But in the case that we're sort of having is that conservative fraction are being very outspoken. And it's almost tantamount, well, it's bullying. And that is kind of, we're lucky that we're protected still in our country, that, you know, bullying is not accepted and it is a criminal offence. And that is what is sort of still sort of protecting, I think, artists here. But
yeah, I wish you could protect them here, but the laws are more lax in this country when it comes to bullying, and you know, it's sad. But I want to talk about happy things because I have my favorite clown in the world on, and I want to play out.
There is a new drag bar opening in Swansea, so that's a positive thing because it's a cabaret bar as well, so it's going to be amazing.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've been working a lot in Swansea over the last sort of 3 to 4 years. There are areas in Wales that are really sort of, I mean, I've, as a clown, the majority of my work has been, I'm sort of UK born, but I've been working in Wales for the last sort of 10 years. Because, you know, I make kids clowning shows, and the Welsh curriculum is set up in a completely different way to the English curriculum. They brought in a new curriculum, well, just before the COVID, so they're still implementing how it works. But, you know, they're using different artistic forms to teach other subjects. And it's like, there's no other, education base in this sort of Western area, and especially in the UK, that puts creativity at the actual heart of how children learn, not just, you know, teaching art as a subject. It's like, if we're going to teach science, we're going to teach it through art. And that's kind of very important to me as a clown, you know, where finding places to actually put a clown. And I think that's, if we're sort of going back to clown history and like where clowning is now, and like, you know, things that have been picked up, like, I know you mentioned drag, but there's also, like, you know, there's quite a lot of fashion for clowning being this sort of therapeutic thing. And, you know, there's a lot of like practitioners and people that are teaching clown now, that it's seen as not just a performance tool and a showcasing tool, it's seen as something that other people are able to actually use and put into how they're like negotiating life. You know, I think that is something that I've been trying to push, especially working with young people who, you know, in this day and age, they're not allowed to make mistakes. There is so much like record of everything that they do, and they put such pressure on themselves. You bring something like a clowning tradition in that says that we want you to make a mistake. We want you to view something like you've never seen it. You don't have to know as much as everybody else. You don't have to research it straight on the internet. You have to look at the banana and figure out what it is. And that is like liberating in a way. And that's, I think clowns have always been, you know, if you're looking at what they do and being a reflection of humanity throughout history, it's very interesting to look at the clowns we've got now and how clowns are being used now and what it's actually saying about our society. I think you mentioned earlier on a little bit about the scary clown phenomenon. I know that we in the UK had quite a, I think it was sort of like a couple of incidences of people dressed up as clowns scaring people in the area. And I know, I think you had some sort of like copycat things in America as well around about the same time.
And that, we did. But of course, ours goes back to like John Wayne Gacy, the serial killer who was a clown, even though he was never in clown makeup and he was killing people, folks. That's a misconception.
No. I think it's interesting to look at that time period of clowning as well. You know, you've kind of, I think we sort of talked about that, like hitting that grit wall of 1946 with Bozo the Clown, and then you're sort of going into corporate America and what clowning stood for, and it becoming like children's party entertainers and the balloon guy.
Yeah, the balloon animal guy at your kids' party was the clown.
There's a whole generation of kids that grew up quite traumatized by bad performers during that period. You know, people like John Wayne Gacy, who in his spare time put on clown makeup, and it started to get this association with people that weren't necessarily savory.
No, and that's a good way to say it.
Clowning didn't help itself as an institution, because it sort of very much affiliated itself with setting up a set of rules that clowns were not allowed to do in this time period. So sort of talking early 70s, a reaction to that kind of clowns becoming a bit creepy. You know, the clowning ministry sort of set up a very Christian organization and said that, you know, if you were a practicing clown, you had to, you know, not be drunk in makeup, or not be, you know, using swear words or obscenities, not putting your makeup on in front of people, not smoking in makeup, you know, lots and lots of rules. And also being part of the church, which is something that was set up with Clowns International sort of quite early on, when, you know, clowning became, I don't know if you know in this country, but actually our sort of clowning museum, so to speak, is held by a church in Dalston, which is where Joseph Grimaldi was buried, who was the first clown, well, the first sort of incident, the word clown being used to describe a character he created in the, like, it was sort of 1805, maybe, the first instance of the word clown. And that kind of face that we have, the white face with the red makeup. And in the UK, there's lots of little eggs, and they have people's makeup on them as a form of copyright. There's also a big collection of them in America, which is
yes. owned by
the Clown International. So it's interesting that around this period, you know, Clowns International and the Christian organisation sort of stood around clowns to try and be like, you know, it's not something that's going to be taken away by this kind of scary capitalist grotesque thing. But unfortunately, I think clown has a mind of its own, and actually clown's always been, when you're sort of looking at it through history, from, like, you know, jesters, minstrels, Shakespeare's fools, you know, going into those early music hall clowns and circus clowns, you're looking at a character that is always standing on the fringe. Like, we talked about how the audience interaction and them being in on it, and they being the only character that does that, makes them stand alone as sort of like a mirror. And if you try and say a clown is something, a clown in the next generation or next evolution of clowning will pop up as exactly what you said it is already not. And I think you're starting to see that now with the scary clown, where, you know, that was a phenomenon that happened, where sort of slightly informed by the It movies, slightly informed by the serial killer clown tradition, and it gathered such a lot of movement. And I'm speaking to teenagers in schools, and they kind of love it. And it became I think it was especially in this country, I remember going out at Halloween and being like, wow, all the girls are dressed as, like, sexy clowns instead of sexy cats. And all the boys are dressed in the gruesome clown mask instead of the, like, it was really, like, traditional Scream makeup and things that was prior to that. And clowning had this really strange resurgence that was to do with this grotesque form of character. And I think that's really interesting to look at where the world was at that point and how uncertain that youth was, and how, you know, the time period of having Trump in power and us feeling like the world could do anything at those times and we have no control over it. Our clowns become these menacing, scary reflections of society. And you've got
even the perceptions do too. If you look at the laughing sales from old amusement parks, which were at one point viewed as loving, people loved them, and then they became creepy, but nothing changed about them except our perceptions.
I mean, I try to think back, like, what made me interested in clown, and I know the point it turned, but I never think about having clowns in my life as a child. And then I remembered that I had one porcelain clown doll. It was really 80s. Everybody had them. And it was, you know, like porcelain clown doll face, and it's got a stuffed body and porcelain hands. And it's in my bedroom. Some family member had bought me it for something, and it was there for ages, and I never played with it. It was always there, and it looked at me, and it was weird. And, like, you know, it was kind of one of those, like, that turning period where dolls and things from the last era become spooky. And that, like, remnants of clowns, especially when I was growing up in the sort of 80s and 90s, they become this spooky thing. And
yeah, thank Poltergeist for that.
Yeah, Poltergeist.
That's a big thing to do with it.
Definitely. I think that there's, you know, there's quite a lot of, I think there's an early episode of The Red Skeleton that is, like, featuring a killer clown in the circus. And the idea that, like, you know, it's a masked character, and therefore it is hiding something, or could be anybody. that's kind of the response that you have. I mean, I wouldn't say I was a scary clown, but I do have the ability to be able to know how to turn that on very easily as like a device, if you see what I mean. But I've tried to always maintain being sort of like that very traditional. I mean, I definitely set out as a character to try and embark on getting that traditional sort of August character back into sort of circulation, because it really wasn't fashionable when I started doing it sort of early 2007. And like, that seems like it's no time of like ago when I first got that nose on. And it kind of, you know, a lot of the clowning that was around in the sort of 60s, 70s, 80s that was, you know, contemporary clowning, you're looking at people like Petra Lilly or Salva, or you're looking at Lecoq and Gollier who went, oh, we're going to take clowning and make it an artistic form again, we're going to take all that makeup off of it. And that happened to circus as well, you know. Circus got all of the sequins and the feathers and all of the animals stripped away from it, and everybody's in skinny jeans and hanging from chains and, you know, doing very expressive things with contemporary circus, which was fantastic and it looked amazing. Then they bring lights back into it and you get Cirque du Soleil, and suddenly we're bringing our clowns back in, but they've got jungly things on their heads and big. It's still clown, you know, it's still like this grotesque format that is this absurd character that comes in and breaks action and has the audience on side and has an innocence that allows them to play with that environment that is the spectacle.
I've always seen elements of clowning in just about every form of pop culture. I've seen the elements of clown in pop music, especially through every change of pop music. It's there. I mean, especially glam, of British glam of the 70s. I mean, it's pure clown. Wonderful music, some of my favorite music, but...
Well, I think that element of, you know, there's a, within the performance world, you get those archetypal characters, don't you? And, like, I think... if you're looking at like a good pure form of it, like going to Commedia dell'arte, which is like, you know, in the Renaissance when they sort of, the Italians made this very, very like symbolic form of physical theatre that was meant to be able to travel around the world and tell the same stories to different people. And it worked brilliantly. And, you know, those types of characters, and that's, you know, where clown originated, into Harlequin and then through to actually what we have as clown, those characters are throughout storytelling, and they're very, very good at being like, oh, the types of performers fit very into these typecasting roles, and it is hard not to do it. But, you know, if you're going to be a performer, like you're saying, within like a musician or something, you know, you can either be the supremely confident, you know, absolute, not going to have any of the, like, you know, chink in the armor, there is no fourth wall, or you're going to be somebody that is able to make a fool of themselves in order to get to entertain. And, you know, that classic underdog thing as well, that the weirdo can suddenly be the most entertaining person on stage, has come very much from that clown, you know, tradition. So, like, people playing as well, you know, play is something that it's very difficult not to take on that innocence that's associated with clown if you want to be playful with something. And pop music in itself is a playful environment, and pop culture is a playful environment. So you're going to see that, you know, so much stuff symbolically is now connected to the idea of clown, that, you know, even a primary coloured, bright coloured things, big collars, suddenly clown fashion is back in thing, and it's still like informing culture now as you speak. Like, I recently did a fashion shoot for Vivienne Westwood, which I kind of found it quite strange when I was there that a lot of the stylists went, oh, this is the fourth clown we've done. Oh yeah, we've done another clown. Who do we do the clown for? And they were chatting amongst themselves about the clown that they'd done for another thing, and they were like, oh, it must be in at the moment. And I was like, I wonder what wonder whether it is just sort of a sudden little spark in trend that, like, suddenly we're going to throw some clowns down a catwalk because it's suddenly big collars are in. And, like, you know, and it was quite bizarre to have been, like, typecasted as a clown on a catwalk where you would usually see very tall, wonderful women. Instead, they wanted a very sort of short, squat, dumpy clown with a big red nose on in the same dress. But, you know, it was a bizarre, but it's
kind of, prefer the clown.
I think that, you know, the fact that fashion and pop culture and mainstream culture has to be playful, and what symbolizes play more than a clown? I think, you know, I've had opportunities for lots of adverts and things, and you know, being on television for stuff, and it is usually when what the, like, the symbol that they're looking for, even if it is a 0.5 second flash of a clown, is that it's either scary or playful. And I fit into the playful category. So, you know, I'll be in the back of an advert doing this because my face and my being represents joy or playful, or even, you know, the fashion for that sad clown thing. I get quite a lot of, like, companies will contact me and be like, oh, you've got that sad clown thing absolutely perfectly. We want that. And, you know, I come and I'd be a sad clown for a day and I sit around looking mopey. And you're like, somebody wants to pay for a full immersion for a day that a clown can represent very easily. So it's interesting.
I said, though, you do it better than anybody else I see do it.
I don't know. I think one of the main problems is that clowns are quite a funny breed, and a lot of us won't take pictures of ourselves or film ourselves or put it out there in a respect that it gets very much documented in the same way. I know a lot of practicing clowns, I know, and people that are still sort of, you know, training as clowns, there is this big sort of thing of you have to go through this process of absenting an ego. And if you can't do that, you can't truly connect with the film. Filming ruins that. So, I mean, I started being a clown on Instagram long after I'd been a performing clown. So I'd been performing as a clown for a long time before I had an Instagram account. And I ended up having to have an Instagram account because somebody else had taken pictures of me and made an Instagram account. And it wasn't me, but it was somebody. And there are something like, there's over 1,000 pictures of me for sale on the internet, which don't belong to me, they belong to the photographer because they've been taken in a public setting, or somebody's done paintings of pictures that they've bought that have been then put onto something else that's been put on a t-shirt, and I have no control. I've been put in books that I've never read, and, you know, I've had one of my friends who was he was a lecturer at a university on a photography course. And he sent me a picture saying, do you know who's the photographer of this picture? And I said, oh, yeah, this is a girl called Steph Hartop. And he went, oh, you know, this picture's one of my students has just tried to submit it as their work.
Wow, it's pretty brazen.
And, you know, this was good 10 years ago. Where he was like, yeah, they've obviously lifted it off the internet, but they think it's an obscure picture, but they don't realise that I know the person in the picture. And it was very bizarre, like, when that started to happen, that my actual image as a clown and the makeup and the facial expressions went beyond me, if you see what I mean. Like, I've been sent flyers from events in Japan with me on the front. Don't know who the person is. It's some weird, strange kitten cafe somewhere that's got a clown theme for the weekend, and they've just lifted the picture straight off the internet, put it straight onto a card. But I have to be okay with that because I have to be, like, the makeup stands for something else. And if that goes beyond me and that face gets remembered, because that was the initial sort of thing with the clown makeup, especially the August makeup, and how you recognized a clown, because I think that we haven't really touched on the fact that clowns were the sort of initial celebrities, really. They were the sort of first global phenomenon celebrities, because they became so connected to the actor playing the character that they're like, you know, tales of the next commedia dell'arte troupe coming to the town, or the specific fool playing in Shakespeare, and then Joseph Grimaldi creating a new character and being chased from theatre to theatre. And then, you know, you're then watching this idea of a household name clown develop, especially in America, where you're following the names of these clowns because they're the only people in the circus. You know, they're kind of the type of walker. You have your ringmaster, but the clown has a name. This is Berzer, this is Gerzer, this is Glock, this is Kirker. And they have a makeup and the kids can draw the face, you know. And that travelled so well. And then, of course, you get Chaplin, who was, you know, actually the first ever megastar, and that was a clown. And you sort of, before pop singers and things like that had that image control, clowns had it. So you watch it move very rapidly through mainstream culture and pop culture, like you were saying. You know, the very first like clown that was ever used in advertising was sort of back in the very early 1900s, where you find a clown called Chocolat, who actually, you know, invented the August thing. And it was interesting as well that he was a Negro performer in America, and he in Paris, and he was the first clown that was ever used in advertising and became this global celebrity. Like after Grimaldi, he was the next very important clown. And this celebrity and this great character and how important people were within like the culture, that sort of dies out around about the 1950s, and we don't get household name clowns anymore, and they're not seen as celebrities anymore.
I think that could be because, like you said, so many of the clowns you know don't want to be documented, don't want to be filmed. It's almost an ego, which I say is criminal, because these things need to be documented for history. That's why I want to do a show like this, so it's there for posterity, so it's there. The history and tradition needs to be... No, go.
The clown will evolve however it faces humanity to evolve. So I'm now looking at the like generation coming up behind me, which is a lot of females with phones and computers doing makeup, and there is a whole world of this thing called clown sona, which is an Instagram phenomenon and a TikTok phenomenon that I have no connection to in any way, shape or form. But yet when I very first started documenting and having pictures of me put on the internet, I faced a big backlash from the clowning community of working clowns, who were like, oh, you're not a practicing clown, you're just a girl, a model. I think a lot of people just thought I was a model on the internet, which I actually had the photos from working performances, and I've been very careful over the years to make sure that the output of what I do is very performative on the internet, because I didn't actually want to be known as a model, and that's how I didn't want to just be taking the makeup and adopting it for something for this Instagram gain. I still wanted to have a working clown life outside of the internet. But I now see that is the complete opposite direction. There are women who have bigger following of clowning followers, like, you know, millions of people following them, and they get up every day and they do silly things in front of their computer screen. And actually, who am I to say they're not clowns? They are using that as their, like, you know, they are almost the sort of reflection of the women who are doing all of the makeup tutorials to try and look normal in everyday life on the internet, which is sold for the women as how we've got to look. And there is a generation of young girls who are painting their faces white and putting red noses on and doing tutorials how to look the most bizarre they possibly can. And I will watch it and I'll laugh at it and love it, because that is why I'm involved in this particular art form. I see it as being very intrinsic and a very good measure of of society and how it works.
And it's a living art form. Like you said, it's a constantly evolving and growing and changing art form. There are certain fundamentals that will always be there, but it constantly grows and changes. And I think a lot of performers have a problem when whatever art form they're in changes, they can't stand it because it's not theirs anymore. But art isn't theirs. It's for the world. And it's got to grow and it's got to evolve.
Completely. I mean, I've recently been revisiting, going through sort of like art history, because it's something I did in school. And, you know, it sort of suddenly dawned on me a couple of months ago. I was like, oh, like I sort of know what Impressionism is, but did it come before or after? And I was like, I don't know. As an adult, I don't know. And I thought, that's, you know, that's actually something that I'm going to spend like a couple of weekends, visit the Tate Modern and go through that and actually make myself a little timeline. Because as an adult, I'm suddenly going, well, you know, I know loads about clown history, but actually, what does it stand to? What was happening in art at that time? And, you know, actually just doing a little timeline for myself before this, for the podcast, just so that I didn't get anything in the wrong order, which will happen. But definitely being there in the wrong order. suddenly my mind starts to link up with the history of art timeline. I'm like, oh, so that's interesting, like the silent era and how clowns actually evolved next to art and like how it's really informed each other. And that hadn't occurred to me. I know it will have occurred to somebody somewhere in an academic clown book, but reading academic clown books is kind of defeating the object of having
it doesn't make sense.
There are some very good ones out there. There's some very interesting, like, sort of literature on clowning and people studying clown at, like, academic level. And, you know,
But, for example, when we were messaging each other back and forth trying to set up the show, we had both brought up Harpo Speaks, Harpo Marx's autobiography, which is filled with clown philosophy.
Yeah.
And it's just as good a book.
Just as good a book as trying to read. I think that, you know, Harpo Marx has got a lot. Clown is a philosophy and a movement, like, and thinking about how, like, thinking like a clown can inform your sort of normal everyday life and outlook. Like, Harpo Marx is just so good at being a real, like, you quite often, you know, people associate clowns with one of two things, very depressing or very, very happy people. And there's two sides to that. And Harpo Marx is actually one of those genuine gems of clowning, who's just a very level, solid individual whose, like, philosophy on life is beautiful and is very, like, you know, he's how he brings his family up and how he feels, you know, towards his wife and his children is just as important to him as getting the correct timing on a prop. And that's, you know, he's a very real and almost like a clown scientist for me, Harpo. Like, I love him as...
Years ago, I once met a man who, as a child, was Harpo Marx's paper boy. And said, when he would go to the door to collect, if it was Harpo who answered, he would never answer the door without his wig on. He had to have his Harpo wig on to open the door, even for the paper boy. And he just said that was wonderful. He didn't want the paperboy to see him not as Harpo. That's just amazing.
I think there is, you know, for me, especially when I was much younger, I didn't, lots of, like you said, it was quite strange to see me in the without the makeup on in the podcast. But I think that clowns often, you know, we there's a reason we have that character. There's a reason that we adopt that, like, something that is a sort of symbol of us being silly in that way. And, you know, him having the wig on when he opened the door was maybe sort of in his way, sort of his barrier against the world. You know, the world can smile at me.
I just wanted to make the kid happy.
If the world can smile at me, then, like, you know, I can have my paper, and that's, like, you know, just the wig will make you smile. And it is something as simple as that. The wig and the shape of his head with the wig on stands for so much more than just him, which makes that child happy, you know. or anybody happy if they saw it, I'm sure.
Well, exactly. It would make anybody, well, it would definitely make me happy. What if you've done everything? You've done the fashion shoots, the music videos, the film sets, you've street performance to, you know, large venues to, you know, which one still do you get a bang out of doing? I mean, which one gives you that adrenaline rush, that push, the one you really love where your passion is for it?
I think that's quite hard to sort of say as, like, the one that I definitely fear the most, that I have to push myself the most to do, that I actually do try and push myself the most to do, is working on the street. Because I kind of started out that way because I didn't think I was very good at something. So I sort of put myself in front of the most brutal audience, because if you want to get better at something, you know when you've got good at something, because that audience will start to respond and laugh. So it was like, until I can make those people laugh or feel or anything, I know I'm not sort of ready to move off of the street. And then, you know, I've gone inside, and like you said, I've gone on to do lots of different other things, like film shoots and adverts and theatre and circus and nightclubs and periodically over the last 20 years, I've taken myself back to street performing, because that's kind of been, you know, I couldn't afford to go to clown school. It's very expensive. You know, like there is still the odd thing in America, clown school, and there is, you know, Gollier and Lecoq, or you could go do corporeal mime if you wanted to earn the physicality, but actual clown school is very, very expensive, and I'd already wasted my student loan on a really important degree, so I couldn't go and do that. So I kind of used the street as my teacher, and copying other street clowns and trying things out in front of an audience that weren't paying, and I would know if I'd got it right because they'd pay or they'd laugh. So it was a very immediate thing, and I take myself back, and I've done that throughout my career and gone, oh, I think I'm really good, do I? I wonder if I can make this work on the street. And, you know, sort of ended up developing acts on stage in like the Hippodrome in central West End London, and then going, hang on a minute, does this actually work on the street? Or is this just some promoter's good idea to put me in these giant, massive shoes? Let's see. Talk about them. Oh, actually, it's all right. It does work on the street. People do find it funny and strange, and they laugh at it. Cool, well, I'll take it back inside. And, you know, that for me was still, you know, I very much in the last sort of couple of years closed down a lot of the actual physical performance that I've been doing, mostly for health reasons. So working as a slapstick clown and a sort of semi-contortionist for the best part of 20 years, and 20 years previous to that, doing quite a physical ice skating sport, I'm suffering quite a lot of injuries, which, if we want to bring this back to Little Titch, which was how you actually...
discovered you, yeah.
You know, he was a performer who was working in music hall and was, at the time, one of the most important clowns of that period. You know, he was a household name clown. He also did something very similar to me, and he stole some local other celebrity's name and used it as his own. So he was actually somebody, Archibald Titchbald, who'd been in the press as one of the most notorious criminals. He nicked his name, and then everybody remembered who he was because he was a little version of him. So that's how he gained his fame. I actually stole a lady in EastEnders which is a popular name that everybody already knew in this country, so that I could just, you know, they remembered it because they already knew the name, but it was funny that I'd stolen the name. So it's kind of similar thing. Clowns have these senses of humor. But he, obviously, the trick that he did in music hall was he stood on the end of his toes in a pair of 28 inch long shoes and did the, like, leaning forward like Michael Jackson was, so his nose nearly touched the floor. And he was only able to do that because he had some, he was, you know, double jointed and quite a short man. And it turns out that the only reason I was able to do it is because I also have some sort of autoimmune condition that made me double jointed, and I'm quite short. So you sort of find your ways to these strange tricks the next trick I found was, you know, being able to put myself through a tennis racket in four different directions. And
which is mind-boggling, by the way.
But, you know, I mean, it's a really standard street performing trick done a lot by men, often quite large looking men, look larger than the tennis racket. But actually, if you can put your shoulder blades together like that, it makes your body very, very slim, and they can get the tennis racket down. And the actual trick is to build the audience up into believing you're not going to get through the tennis racket, and then you get yourself.
Well, yeah, through. Except I can't lift my leg past my hip, let alone.
Also, I'm 5 foot nothing, and when I've been working on the street for a long time, very, very, very skinny person. So for me to put myself through a tennis racket, got absolutely no laughs whatsoever, other than people going, well, you're small, of course you can get through it. So I had to find a way of getting through it, you know. So I was like, okay, well, I'm going to put everything through at once and see if I can get through it. And okay, I'm just going to put my head through it first. And actually, really sort of, when I took that out onto the street, it took me 3 years working that act on the street to actually get the build up of it right, so that it could then go inside as a 2.5 minute act. But when I first took it out on the street, all of the men that were out there with the tennis racket, and they were like, oh, damn. Like, it kind of took it a step further. And I wasn't the only person in the world doing that. There was another couple of women doing it, but we sort of all hit on it at the same time, which is great. But it's kind of like, I think, you know, I've talked loads about the history of clowning, and not once have I hit upon women in clowning. So I think I'm gonna just do a small little like chunk of women in clowning, just
please.
I am a woman in clowning, and I sort of set about it knowing very much that it's probably one of the most male-dominated art forms in history, like more than any other. Like, painting has even got more, you know, since the 1960s at least, you know, we have more female painters. We still don't have, you know, if I'm when I started making a list of the important clowns, not one of them on there is a female. And, you know, there were female clowns, but they just didn't have the same impact, and there was never as many of them, and quite a lot of them dressed as men anyway, so you didn't know whether they were female clowns or not. The androgyny suggested around the clown character often, you know, it was never a personified female clown. And then, you know, actually coming into the sort of the death of that circus clown, and that kind of the 1940s onwards, and you're starting to look at people going back to clowning being this important thing. Women really took up the mantle of being this clown character and pushing it to completely different places that men did. I mean, you're looking at artists like Angela de Castro and Petra Lilly, who are like creating grotesque clowns and clowns that really question femininity, because you're sort of looking at a mirror for humanity, and suddenly women are important in humanity for the first time, or being recognised as having been important in humanity for the first time. And you see the adaptation of a female clown. And I kind of came at it at a time personally when I was sort of coming out of university amongst a tradition of a lot of very talky stand-up comedians from the Footlights Cambridge like area, and being very much like, oh, all they do is talk, everybody talks really posh, everybody's, you know, very, very like, has to be clever, it has to be so clever. Alan Carr, he's very, very clever. And I kind of went, oh, do you know what? I'm going to take the complete opposite of what the men are doing and do the opposite of that and see if I can be a comedian doing it. And I'm not going to say it worked in terms of, you know, I'm definitely not as well financially off as maybe some of my peers that did go on to do talking and stand-up comedy and script writing and the important comedy that is earning the money. But I think that I really wanted to set out more than anything to just get other women interested in clowning as an expression, as something that's fun to do in a life that's quite, you know, demanding of women and women achieving now, and us having to deal with lots of things that are coming up from the past and the trauma of being women and not listened to. And I think clowning has definitely providing an avenue for that. And I'm sort of very proud that I chose as a woman to go into an art form that, and I didn't think about it either. I didn't actually think, right, I'm going to be a girl clown and I'm going to make it a very girl thing. I just made a clown, and that clown has been female and male and has appealed therefore to lots of different markets, you know, from very conservative markets. You know, I've worked in, you know, education and with churches and different religions and lots of different people from lots of different cultures, as well as, you know, sort of underground cultures and places that are considered fringe of society, or even like, you know, slightly rural and other places like that. And I feel like the clown has such an important sort of expression amongst actual real people that it's only that character that can do it, and being a female or a male actually doesn't affect the power of that character. So it's, I'm really interested to see what women do with clowning in the next sort of 20 years and where that's going.
See, in America we were lucky that in that post-40s era, the 50s and 60s, the best clown in America was a woman in Lucille Ball. I mean, so.
Yeah, I mean, interesting, because you're looking at women adopting the clowning mentality without the makeup.
Yep.
So you're getting through, and, you know, you do start to see, and you did start to see from sort of actually Buster Keaton onwards, you're starting to see the clown without makeup on and it becoming, and the Marx Brothers and things. And Lucille Ball really nailed that, actually being able to be a physical female performer that, you know, at the time, I don't think she was called clown. I think that's something that was sort of labelled on her much later in her career, after she'd completely made that career based on this character and this persona that was so in line with clowning, but nobody noticed. You know, she's a very sly underdog that got in there as the sort of confident situation, but still had those very innocent roots and the ability to make mistakes and it still be joyful. And I think that's, you know, that's why everybody loved it.
Well, she also slid by people because she kept it feminine.
Mm-hmm.
She never lost the femininity, especially in the first series, The I Love Lucy. I mean, she was as feminine as you can get. She was a wife and a mother. I mean, she was
a woman. She was a wife and a mother that grimaced. And she's a wife and a mother that pulled faces to the camera that other audiences didn't. You know, she's a wife and a mother, but she had that, like we were talking about, the inside, like, connection with the audience, that she was almost in on the fact that she's playing a role, and that, like, you know, that she can see them when she can't see them. And that connection made, like, you know, an entire generation fall in love with it. And it is the power of that clown and that intoxication. And she, like you said, she nailed it. She's one of the greatest female clowns of all time without having to be a clown. You know, she took, you know, without having to have the makeup and the big signifiers of clown.
And she was a local girl. She's from about a half hour away from me. Her museum is right up the road.
It's nice because my actual real name is Lucy as well. It's not Dots.
Well, I love that you talked about nicking the name. When I first discovered you, I started sending clips to Lauren saying, we have to find this clown. We have to get this clown on the show. And I said, before she even watched the clip, she saw me put the name through, and she just sent back to me, from the EastEnders, she's not a clown. Didn't you, Lauren?
I did. I was a bit confused, first of all, because we have to find this woman, Dot Cotton. And I was like, what? That would be a bit difficult these days.
Yeah, I mean, it was, for me, that was a joke. And I love the American like Passover of that Jerkins, the English, like we laugh about it, but it was quite funny sort of 10 years ago when you started to Google Doc Cotton, because they'd changed the character, had got married, that actually you started to get pictures of June Browning, the actress, and me at the same time on Google. And she became aware of it. And one of the girls I was working with was also an extra in EastEnders as a hairdresser. And she'd gone to her, to the actress, "You know, my friend is a clown and she uses your name." And the actress went, "Yes, I know. Somebody showed me a picture of her the other day." And I thought, it, like, for me, that was the ultimate joke, that actually I did with her Google algorithm before algorithms are really a thing, by being the more clicked Doc Cotton in the UK for a short period of time. But obviously she recently passed away, is no longer with us, so the internet stream is now just for her face. But I will creep back in there as she passes into the depths of time and the joke becomes obsolete and archaic. But
yeah, imagine my surprise when I was Googling you and said, "Wow, she looks so much younger in makeup."
Yeah. I think it's a common misconception that the clown makeup ages you also. Having worked outside in clown makeup for most of my like younger years, the rest of the skin on my body is wrinkly, but my face is still quite okay. I think I've had like a good sort of 2 to 3 layers of makeup, which is the most effective sunblock known to man. So it's kind of, yeah, when I was out working on beaches in Spain, I'd have bright red arms and the whitest face, even in everyday life. So it looked quite
cute. Do you use traditional clown white?
Yeah. So I'm quite basic. I have tried every type of clown makeup on the UK market and even a few in other countries that I've picked up. But I'm still working with the Kryolin white clown grease paint, which has been sort of around since the 1920s. It's a very similar format to what it was in originally, and it is just a lanolin based white paraffin. And
which is, that's why the skin's so perfect, because you need the cold cream to take it off, so that just helps everything.
Well, like quite a lot of clowns set it with powder, which is something that, like, when you, I think if you watch the Ringling Brothers or the Barnum Bailey one, they're showing you how to put makeup on, they still set it with the talcum powder, and I still see people doing it, and I just go, why? I basically just put the grease paint on and pat it down, because I find that if you put the powder on, you then can't, if you smear it, for some reason, if you touch anything, it then comes off on the things that you touch, and it comes off of your face. But if you just put the grease on, it's indestructible. It will last, I've been in it like 15 hours sometimes, and so I'm looking in the mirror and gone, yeah, it's fine. And, you know, and it doesn't move, and I've sweated through sand, and I've sweated through hair spray, and like, you know, 6-hour raves and things in this makeup, and it's not moved. And people go, how have you glued the nose on? And like, I'm using old-fashioned spirit gun, like, which I'm worried to death they're going to discontinue because it's found to be toxic for your face, which I know it's toxic for your face, but it works. So if you don't...
Damn it if it works.
And like, I've worked with like Father Christmases suffer so difficultly with trying to hold that beard on with spirit gum throughout a, like, you have no idea that working as a clown, like the Christmas period is intense, but you working as a Father Christmas in a grotto is probably, I imagine, you can only do it for a couple of years of your elderly life, and it better be well paid. But they've got to constantly be sticking this spirit gum on this, and this is the wettest place of your face to stick the beard on their face. And I've watched them use all different kinds of things, and I've even seen Santa Claus's super glue that beard on their face to stop kids getting off, because, you know, makeup isn't always designed, you know, you get the prosthetic makeups that's used for like film sets and things, but on a film set you've got somebody coming in and I've seen it every 5 seconds to make sure that's glued down. Whereas if you're a working clown, you've got to put a nose on a beach and hope it stands up to 12 hours straight performing. And if it falls off or some, you know, naughty child rips it off your face, that you're going to be able to get it back on quickly. So I think I'm quite traditional where the makeup's concerned, and like sticking to the old brands that work and are likely to give me malignant skin cells in my face. But
I thought the powder was to prevent it from coming off from sweating.
Yeah, apparently all that happens to me when I sweat with the powder on is you just see the sweat, whereas if through the grease, it just seems to drip off.
That's what I was going to say. If you're going to 6 hours of makeup at a rave, you're sweating and it stays on.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I'm on stage, I'm not with people. So it's like, you know, if I was doing that kind of environment, or even like, you know, working somewhere like Dubai, where it's so hot in the makeup that the, you know, if you're doing something where you walk around an outside like area in a pool, your face is like dripping here at the end. And I can't imagine what it must have been like in the like early days of clowning, when they're using, you know, basically lanolin and chalk, which is like the original clown makeup. So you sort of like, you know, the fat off of the sheep wool, and like how sticky that gets, and it will hold and suspend the chalk in it, and essentially smearing it onto your face, and then getting in a tent out in Dust Bowl America and holding onto a horse for 3 shows a day. Like, you know, this stuff was built to last. And, you know,
we had a previous guest on, we were talking about early Hollywood makeup and how everything was done with spirit gum, cotton, and collodium, which collodium is wonderful, except it'll burn your skin if you put it in the same spot twice.
And it was all lilac and brown, wasn't it? So actually, yeah, all of the makeup looks like it's black and white. And mm-hmm. I recently worked for the Chaplin Foundation. They're a charity obviously set up by Charlie Chaplin's family, and they auction off bits of stuff and they make donations to children in Peckham. And fund them into arts projects, so kids in from which was where Charlie Chaplin was from. And they were auctioning his violin, and they wanted a performer to dressed as Chaplin with the violin, but obviously them being sort of the Chaplin Foundation, they didn't want to use a Charlie Chaplin impersonator, they wanted to use another female clown. And at the time I was working in Peckham, so, and they insisted that I didn't do the black and white makeup, that I actually did the like white face with the brown makeup and the lilac like things, so that when they took the picture on the old fashioned camera in the auction house, they had the same effect as his makeup. And I didn't know that it was those colours. I had no idea. But that was really interesting to learn and actually have to look at the like what the colours might have been. But
yeah, that's why everyone thinks Frankenstein was green, because he was. Yeah. Because to get him to look pale and dead, they had to use a green makeup that would look pale and dead on the screen. Just crazy. I feel terrible that, like, it's late and you're both in Wales, so it's, like, really late. And I want to ask one question before we go on, is that would you please come back on, because I could talk to you for 10 hours. And I would love to have you on the show anytime you want to talk about anything you'd like.
I mean, I don't know. I think we've covered quite a lot of clowns, so that's good. I've had a nice sheet of paper here with my dates on, so that I've got all of my clown guys written down in order, just so that I didn't get them in the wrong order.
We can talk about anything you want at any point.
I'm sure you can come up with something. I mean, performing as a history is also something I'm interested in, but it's, you know.
Now, Lauren, do you have any questions before I go on to a rapid fire question round to end the show?
Oh, I forgot about the rapid fire question round, because we haven't had a new guest on for such a long time. I forgot about that. Oh, I'm so sorry for about what's about to happen. No, it's just such a joy to listen to you and to listen about, you know, this fantastic art form. And it's made me think about all the performers, you know, comedy performers that might be considered, you know, clowns, you know, like Dan Leno and all those. And it's just made me smile to think, you know, that it's all big, part of such a big, wonderful tradition that, you know, has touched everybody's life.
I wanted to mention that actually, so I run a theatre company which is based in Wales, but we have an Italian name. So we're called Famiglia della Notte, but we actually have a tour of two children's shows, which are, again, they're clowning based because we wrote them as clown shows, but they're completely in Welsh. So, well, they're bilingual. We do them once a day. I would love to send you that if you were able to see. I know we're in Swansea a couple of times over the summer if you wanted to come see the show.
I'd love that because both my nephews go to Welsh schools, so they speak Welsh, and it's difficult to find things that are contemporary in Welsh because it's all very much constructed by S4C and it can be a bit weird.
No, so we're an independent female run theatre company, which we started working with puppetry and clowning, and then obviously the funding in Wales is very centred towards the Welsh language, so we don't speak Welsh. But we found this amazing contemporary band called HMS Morris, who are like young Welsh speaking, absolutely amazing music. So they sort of, they've written the like Welsh music, and it's all set to music for kids. So it's all like essentially silent clowning done to a Welsh score of music with like dance moves and interaction and stuff. So it's really, but I will send you across the links and the dates that we have in Swansea, and if you want a ticket, I can sort you out.
That would be amazing because it is strange, you know, being a child that speaks Welsh to find cool things other than going to the Eisteddfod.
And oh, I mean, the Eisteddfod is the
Do you speak Welsh as well?
But I have this thing where obviously I've travelled a lot as a silent performer, so I don't really pick up language. However, I've been editing film. I've also run a sound project in Wales, which is like also connected to libraries, where I teach kids basic sort of how to make sound effects. We record them. We record the story. We pick some music. We put it together on Audacity. And we make like an audio story, right up to sort of secondary school children, but works quite well with like babies and books. But I then have to have all these children's soundtracks in Welsh, and the Welsh translation and Google Translate open so that I can edit the films at the same time as learning Welsh. So I can do most of the insects, but that's about it.
Usually it's the swear words you learn first.
But no, I'm working with children, so we may
No, I'm not working with children, so it's the insects.
There aren't any swear words in Welsh. It's a very weird language. We don't have any swear words.
No. Well, we'll have to make some up.
Well, the language is so descriptive that, like, you know, you'd be able to make something up that was vulgar in Welsh, much vulgarer than a swear word, but it wouldn't, you know, it's no shorthand term for it, you know, it's kind of got the...
It's a good point. Well, are you ready for the rapid fire round?
Yeah, why not?
Okay. These are questions, they don't necessarily have anything to do with the topic. They're just random questions you have to answer right off the top of your head, first thing that comes to your mind. And there are no wrong answers unless I tell you you're wrong, then you're wrong.
Okay.
Question one, Pluto, is it a planet or not?
No, it's not a planet.
I'll stick it together, you see, Brian.
No, okay. Two, is it true that whenever you get property in Wales, they give you sheep to live with?
That's false.
Oh, breaking my heart. I'm 0 for 2 here. Okay, 3. Your favorite song about a clown?
Oh, about a clown. George Mingus, The Clown, which is a piece of experimental jazz about a clown that does, that falls over until he doesn't get up again. It's quite sad.
I was going to say, why don't you just say Death of a Clown by the Kinks at that point? I mean, that's sad.
Not very many people know the Mingus one. And it's 15 minutes long, so I used to get in the bath and know that I was in the bath for exactly 15 minutes and listen to it all the way through. So that's definitely my favourite song about a clown. Right, next question.
Your favourite clown in history? Oh, I put you on the spot there. Yeah,
very see. Hard. It is very much between, like, I am kind of hard between the two silent clowns. So it is, and the silent clown history says so Chaplin or Keaton. Like, probably I'm gonna have to say Chaplin just because ballet dancer.
Yeah, well. But plus, he was from the UK and Keaton wasn't. So I understand. You're sticking with loyalties. That's fine. Favorite country to perform in?
I'm going to just say Japan just because of one thing that happened in Japan that's never happened anywhere else in the world. But the audiences there were so perfectly in tune with interaction and wanting to laugh that for a whole 20 minutes, the whole audience pretended with me that an invisible performer was on stage and we were watching them and clapping and laughing at them. And it was all just complete them going with the, oh, there's an invisible, oh, yeah, oh, he's amazing looking. And the entire audience went with it for 20 minutes. So I think that Japan really holds that, like, joy for me of an audience really loving play. And that was really nice.
Favorite food?
Cake.
Cakey cake, as Lauren would say?
Yeah, any type of cake.
Okay. Not like chicken wings? Because, like, you know, I'm from Buffalo.
Cake or butter, that's my favorite type of food.
Okay. When not clowning, how do you relax? I mean, what is your relaxation? I'm on vacation. I'm getting away from it all. What do you do?
I like going. I'm really, really interested in flowers and plants and, like, local fauna. And I collect a lot of stuff. I like identifying plants. I'm pretty good at the UK. So I've kind of been doing that since I was a kid. And I've got, like, a good grasp on what we have in the UK. But then I absolutely love going to a different country and getting my mind blown by something that looks so different, but, like, you know, different time of year. Or, for instance, I've just come back from Sicily and I'm like, all of the flowers here are, like, 2 months ahead. They're different. They're carrot species. And, like, that's what I like doing in my recreation time, looking at plants.
Do you have any plans to come back to the United States or Canada in the near future?
Well, before the COVID, me and my business partner were talking about, we were looking at international touring. We'd just come back from Australia and we were looking at Canada, which I spent a lot of time in Canada as a young ice skater training in my teens. So it was a country I'd really love to go back to. The States I would also love to, but unfortunately money is of the question with the United States, and visas, etc., are very difficult these days. But I think that, you know, it's a country that I haven't been to and I haven't been a clown in, so it would be definitely on the list eventually. I might get there when I'm in my 60s.
Because you would kill in Toronto, first off. Toronto would love you. I mean, that would be your town in Canada.
I've recently, a really good friend of mine, who's a performer in this country, very, 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 very good female burlesque performer, moved to Toronto and gave up performing. She said that it's such a wonderful place. You know, she's just happy being herself. And she's actually very into plants as well.
And she gave up performing in Toronto.
In Toronto, yeah. She was just like, such a lovely place. I don't need to perform here. I can just look at plants and live. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very That's much pretty like impressive.
Country again.
Last question. If you were practicing figure skating in Canada, did you realize all of us that played hockey used to fucking hate you when we'd kick the ice because you figure skaters ruined the ice?
Oh, yeah, completely. But I was really lucky where I was training. So I was at the Mariposa Institute in Bari, and they had separate rinks for the hockey team. To the figure team, so it was kind of we got on quite well with the hockey, like, in Canada, but actually in the UK it was even worse, like the hatred between the hockey teams and the figure teams, because we wrecked the ice.
You destroyed it.
They had more ice time than us, so it's kind of like, you know, I would get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, open the rink with my coach, and train before the hockey team got in at like 8. So I had like that period of time so that the hockey team had the like before school hours and like the peak hours, and then I couldn't come into the rink again till later. And in summer the hockey got the entire, like they had summer schools and things, and I travel out of town or go to Canada to train because I couldn't train because of the hockey.
It's because you ruined the ice. You destroyed it.
They wouldn't let me be a hockey player. That was the problem.
Well, you're 5 foot nothing. What are you going to do?
I was very fast.
Yeah. I was very slow, but I'm 6'5", so. Yeah. So, Lauren, do you have any other questions?
No, just that it's been a joy to have you on the show and to listen to your story and the story of clowning. It's been amazing.
I hope I haven't got too much wrong, but I mean, it's quite hard to sort of make a concise history of clowning. I think, you know, you try and have a look on the internet, but there's so many different like fractions of it, and you know, it's still a recent art form, really. It's only a couple of hundred years old, but it's, yeah, it was really nice to try and have a little jab at getting it in the right order.
I think someone should consider writing a book about it.
I mean, this is my guy. This is, he's a clown teacher in the UK who's like considered to be like the clown academic, who's a man called John Davison, who he's published like a couple of good books on it, which are very like academically written, but they're very like informative, and they look at it from a really interesting point of view, especially as, you know, the sort of history of UK clowning against like the backdrops of different cultures clowning. And his other book is about like, you know, actually how to be a clown and workshops and things like that. So he's one of the people, especially in the UK, that's sort of been working since the 80s at really sort of demystifying this sort of very closed off timeline. So in terms of like a book to go to, I always go to that one for most things if I don't know what I'm talking about, and like have a look and see what he said about it. But I do think there is room within sort of somebody to write a bit more of a like everyday person's guide to clowning, like, you know, funny, an actual funny book about clowning.
I think a clown's view of the history of clowning would make for a fascinating book.
We'll have to find a clown that can write.
I'm sure there are people who could help.
It's getting things like that funded.
What? Is there anything you'd like to promote, pitch, talk about before we let you go? Because I know it's like 3 a.m. for you guys now.
No, I don't think it's that late. I think it's like
just after 11.
Yes. Yeah. My boyfriend's only popped his head down twice and gone, as if to be like, isn't bedtime yet? No, I mean, I run a Welsh theatre company called Familia della Noche. We've got 2 children's tours. Well, it's a tour this summer with 2 different children's shows in Welsh. I've made all of the little puppets for it and the costumes and the props. And we as a company sort of write the things, and then we get some lovely younger people to do the jumping around for us. But other than that, I've not really got very much I'm working on at the moment, other than I'm writing lots of workshops I'm trying to run a program of school clowning projects in Welsh schools and taking it through to the UK, which is not where I work all that often in schools. I've worked quite a lot in Wales, and to be honest, at the moment they're sort of less performing for me and more sort of concentrating on like where the next area is going to be. Because I kind of feel like I've gone through quite a lot of areas in clowning, and I kind of think my main aim with this was to put a clown as many places as you could possibly put it. And I sort of I got a bit of television stuff and film stuff still to go, and then I hope somebody would make me into a cartoon, and then I don't have to do any of the physical moving, and I can just be this as a children's storybook or something, and I can sit at home and drink coffee and look at plants.
Well, whatever it is that you decide to do, I will be there watching, because in all sincerity, you are my favorite clown I have seen since Harpo Marx. There's something so special about your clowning that from the moment I first saw your performances, it just hit me. And it's such a pleasure talking to you, and it's such an honor, and I hope you do come back on the show soon. And again, we could talk about anything. You want to come on and talk about plants, we can do that. I don't care.
Oh, well, I'll pick another history subject I'm interested in. I'm quite interested at the moment in, well, and being around, like, you know, street art and sort of looking at that from sort of cave paintings up to sort of vandalism and things like that that we have now. That's been my recent interest. But maybe we'll talk about that in a bit of time. But yeah, it'd be nice to come back on. I'm going to head off as well, really, because I could do with a drink.
I know the feeling. All right, well, from Swansea in Wales, I have two wonderful women with me tonight. This is Brian in Buffalo, and joining me as always,
Lauren from Swansea.
Good night.
Good night. I eat my poo.